Well, somebody stepped on it.
That's it.
Oh, oh, that's it.
Oh, hey, hey, you tell him what to do.
I forget now which tape this is.
Five.
I'll be in there when I get through these.
Okay. This is tape number 5, September 10, Thursday, 1959. The president and Mr. Hillman and Mr. Noyes for the morning conference.
I'll be in there, sir.
Now, Mr. President, what is happening to the American farmer?
Well, the American farmer is being exploited as he was way back in the 20s. And he's being exploited for the welfare and benefit of those who make loans on farms and on the prices of his products in such a way that he'd be out of business before long.
Now, are we talking about the so-called family farm, or are we talking about all farms?
We're talking about all farms, but particularly the family farm.
Is that a disappearing feature
of
American life?
If this thing keeps up, we'll have the same situation that the Russians are working for, the consolidation of all the farms and have villages where farmers will work, not for themselves, but for somebody else.
So we have the equivalent of a communal farm developing over here under a corporate farm?
That's exactly right.
Well, isn't there some advantage to cooperatives in the sense that farmers will cooperate to hire machinery as well as own machinery?
Well, our cooperatives are excellent, and they've made a great impression on the farmers. But the Russian plan of cooperatives is not our plan.
But isn't it possible that with the modern development and machinery and chemicals that it might be advisable not to have so many small farms, but pooling of farm resources?
Well, the small farm, where the family is raised on the farm, is the best thing that ever happened to this country, and that's what made us great.
Now, you think that it's an important ingredient in our balance of our social elements in the country.
Isn't any question about it.
But now, the farmer has been notoriously conservative in his political position in the country.
Well, that's true. He thinks if he has 160 or 240 acres of land, he doesn't have to pay any attention to anybody. But I think during the last period of 10 or 15 years, he's found out that he has to.
Well, you had a great deal to do in pointing out to him the error of his ways in 48.
I pointed out the error of his ways, and he still voted the Republican ticket.
Not in 48?
Yes, he did. Yes, he did. He voted the Republican ticket in 48 in the vast majority of the farm states, but he shouldn't have done it.
Has he ever come over to the Democratic side?
Well, I don't know. We'll have to find that out in the next election.
Well, he seemed to have come over on the legislative side to the Democrats.
Well, yes, that's right. But then you can't tell what they're going to do. They make up their minds Monday morning, and Saturday night they've changed it.
Well, Mr. President, the farm question seems always to revolve around the overproduction of certain products in this country.
And that is taking place, that's true.
Well, what can be done about it, and can we really call it overproduction if there are so many areas in the world which could use it?
Well, Henry Wallace wanted the ever-normal granary, and that's what we ought to have. And then we ought to take the surplus and see if we can't make deals in international things that'll take care of that surplus.
Would you go beyond that and suggest that the surpluses of all of the farming countries, be pooled into an international pot?
Eventually, that's what I think will have to be done.
Now, you were for the ever-normal granary, but you also were for the distribution of our surplus during your administration.
That's right. I was for the Brannon plan. That's what it does.
Well, Mr. President, I note this morning a dispatch which says that the Russian wheat is down because of a drought they had. Now, let's take a hypothetical case. If we have got so much surplus wheat, do you think it would be wise to give Russia wheat and that sort of thing?
If they can pay for it, I'm for it, but otherwise not. And they can pay for it because they have plenty of gold to pay for it.
You think it's advisable to help them on these
things? Well, of course, in every way we can.
Well, in the case of China, would you take the same position, Red China?
Yes. If they were starving, I'd help them.
But they can't pay for it. Now, how would you handle the Red China situation?
Well, if they can't pay for it and their people are starving, we ought to keep that from happening, just as we have in times past.
Well, you're taking the position now that American agriculture should not restrict its production, but should go on producing all that it can and have enough for our own people, enough to put into the ever-normal granary, and then enough of the surplus to make available to countries that don't. Is that
true? The countries that are starving, yes, sir. Let's put it that way.
I'm surprised that there's dispatch from Boston and a paper the New York Times yesterday says that a Jesuit priest today described the condition of migrant farm labor in this country as an abomination. Father Murphy said that half of the 1 million migrant workers in the country were contract laborers imported from Mexico, the Bahamas, British West Indies, Japan, and the Philippines. Well, isn't that an astounding development that we have to import 1 million?
Well, while I was president, we tried to work that out and got it worked out. And then after I left, they changed over to a situation which the able priest has talked about.
Well, he talks about their living in terrible conditions.
Well, he's right, absolutely right.
In California, they just fired.
California, Arizona, and New Mexico. That's where this thing happens.
I see a lot of them on Long Island and New Jersey. They come
They bring them all over the country, but then that's where they start, in those three states.
There's been some corruption. Some of the farmers made deals with the employment agencies of the state and made disreputable deals where they exploited these people, but that's all being attended to.
Yes, but isn't it amazing that we have to import 1 million workers in the country to...
We don't have to. But you know what they do? They treat them in those states I've named, Southern California, Arizona, New Mexico, as peons. And that's wrong.
Well, it's not as simple as hiring those people. The peach crop of California this year went to pot. It dropped to the ground because they couldn't get pickers. These people are getting better jobs, and they couldn't afford the pickers at these prices.
And that served them right, because they joined with the people who wanted to exploit these poor people who came from Mexico.
Associated farmers.
That's right.
J.V., how are you?
How are you? Wait a minute. This is all. Where were we at this point?
We were talking about these migrant laborers, the use of them.
Well, President of Mexico, Alemán, while I was President of the United States, and I made an agreement on these migrant laborers for their welfare and benefit. And, of course, as soon as I left office, that was thrown out, and I don't know how they're getting along now.
Well, it's a serious strain. Mexico is very unhappy with us, and we seem to have done the wrong thing, because Mexico is not sending any labor up as fast as California can use it.
Well, the agreement that the president of Mexico and I had, while I was president and he was president, was for the benefit of the people who needed labor and for the benefit of the laborers. And that wasn't what the people in Southern California and Arizona and New Mexico wanted. They wanted to exploit them and take everything they made away from them.
You think they ought to get the prevailing wage?
I think they ought to get the prevailing wage.
And there should be no double standard.
That's right.
Mr. President, Mr.
Thomas,
5 minutes.
That'll be all right.
What should our national position be? This is not a state matter. This is something that should be in the hands of the federal government, should it not?
Federal government ought to control it. And that's what I thought when I was president. That's what I tried to get done. And I thought we had gotten it done. But
it's off the track again.
Seems to have gone out the window.
In other words, these laborers ought at least to get decent wages and not peonage
wages. Of course, and they ought not to be charged with transportation and food and things of that kind at a place where the fellow who has control of the situation makes them pay double what they ought to pay for ordinary food.
Yes, that has been a serious problem. Now, what do you think should be done to, what can the government do to put our whole agricultural picture on the same level with the rest of the country's development?
All they've got to do is to make an arrangement with the government of Mexico that the Mexicans, when they come into this country, will be treated just the same as American labor under the same circumstances. That's all that's necessary.
Well, won't that then defeat what most of these fruit growers or farmers want? They want labor which is cheap enough so they can get
their
product.
They want to exploit labor, and they shouldn't be allowed to do it any more than any other outfit in this country.
Well, now we're getting to a very difficult position where the farmer is gradually being upgraded and also being subjected to heavier expenditures than he used to be. And we have labor organized and commanding a higher place in the market. What happens to the consumer in that double squeeze, in your judgment? How do you protect the consumer at that point?
Well, that's a thing that we've got to work out. The consumer is the market for the farmer and for labor and for everything else. And most of the laborers and the farmers are consumers. And when they squeeze themselves out, they get just exactly what they deserve.
Are distribution methods in agriculture antiquated? Is there something we can do about bringing those up to date?
Well, I don't know how you're going to handle that. Around most cities are market gardeners who raise things for the market. For instance, right here in our home county, we have a market for the market gardener. He comes in every morning at 3 o'clock after working the fingernails off his hands and has things to offer. And the merchants, that is the independent merchants, I don't think the chain store merchants ever pay attention to him, go down there and stock up in season on whatever's available, and then come back and offer it to the public. And in old times, they had a chance to make a profit for the gardener and for the retail merchant. Now, I don't know how that thing's handled today because I haven't gone into it, but these market gardeners are still at work in New Jersey and Connecticut and outside of Chicago and Illinois and Wisconsin, in St. Louis County, in Missouri, around the two Kansas cities. And sometime or other, we're going to find a way to protect all of them for the benefit of the consumer. He wants something to eat and he wants to get it as cheap as he can.
But while this is going on, what do we do about making sure that the farm population isn't going to be eroded and diminished to the point where it is threatening to disappear as a family farm?
Well, if they want to make this situation one of the farms like the communists have, that's what will happen in the long run. But I think the individual family farm is much better for the country and much better for the individual. Of course, we're not in the same fix we were after the Civil War, when men could come out and take up land and improve it and make themselves independent. We're now in a position where all the public land nearly has been taken up, and we've got to be in a position to protect the little farmer as well as who could take little business, and neither one of them are being protected at the present time.
Now, you think that the little farmer is needed way and beyond the mere economic facts involved. He's needed for social and political reasons?
Isn't any doubt about that. That's what he's needed for.
He provides, what does he provide? What is his value to the country?
Well, he's independent in his thinking. He's independent in his voting. And when he makes a living, he's perfectly happy. And sends his children to school, and that's all that counts.
Well, may I ask you about this controversial question of whether farmers should be paid money to prevent them from growing things, in other words, letting the land lay fallow?
In some instances, that has been necessary, but I don't think it's a very good thing for the farmer.
Well, can you elaborate on that, Mr. President, why you don't?
Well, I think the farmer, all the farmer wants is a fair price for what he raises. He doesn't want any pay that he doesn't earn, and that's one of the things that's caused all the trouble in the country with the farmer. Pay them for what they don't do, and then the big farmers get the benefit of it, not the little ones.
So what we're talking about is that the farmer should go on producing, and we should try to find a market for what he produces.
That's correct. And not only that, we ought to be willing to help the small farmer and not the fellow who's working toward the Russian consolidation of the farm program.
Well, you think that it's important for the political balance. It's a kind of a checks and balance in the economic sense and a social sense to have an independent farmer as one of our important components.
We must have it. We must have independent farmer. We must have laborers that get a fair wage. We must have industry that is working for the welfare and benefit of the people of this country. And in the long run, they'll all get together because it's for the welfare of all of them that we're working.
Well, Mr. President, just as you pointed out yesterday, what is necessary is to protect the small enterprise, because that is really the competitive enterprise under our system. So that should be extended into the agricultural area.
Oh, yes, it ought to be in every area. It ought to be in every area, particularly agriculture.
You've always taken the position, have you not, sir, that you were not for one and against the other. You were for both big and little, that you had to be little before you get big, so
that
you have
an advantage. The President of the United States must look after the people who can't look after themselves with pull. And when the President of the United States doesn't look after the little fellow in business, in farms, or in any other line, they don't have anybody to look after.
Unless you have some questions,
no,
I'd like to jump somewhere else just for a minute to just sort of get the change.
All right, Bill.
You get quite a lot of letters. People come in and visit and talk to you. I've often been intrigued to know, in asking you about your administration over the past, what questions about your administration are the most asked? What is it they want to know about it?
Well, of course, they all want to know what caused the Cold War. And I try to tell them that the only cause of the Cold War was the fact that the Russians didn't keep their agreements. That's the principal question I hear every day.
What about the, are you frequently asked about the atomic bomb and about the...
No, not frequently. Once in a while, I'm asked by one of these synthetic liberals why the atomic bomb had to be dropped. And then I give him the information of Stimson and Patterson, who were Secretaries of War and Secretary of Defense when I was President. And also the ideas of all the people who had worked on the situation, that the idea was to end the war and save lives. They hadn't heard of it, most of them had, because the propaganda has been that the Greek and Turkish program, the Berlin airlift, and the Korean situation was one of my pet projects. It was not. The idea was to save the free world, and that's all there was to it.
How did you go about the business of making a decision? What did you do? Did you depend upon your own judgment most of the time, or did you combine your judgment with the advice that you got from experts?
I listened to all the information I could get, the background of every question, how it originated, what it meant, and what the ideas were in the future, and talked with the people whom I thought were most interested in the welfare of the country and who would give me their viewpoint exactly as they thought, which is hard to get. Most of them try to find out what you want to hear and then give it to you. But the ones I had around me didn't do that. And when I got all the information I could get, I studied it, then made the decision, and that was it.
Well, what part of the day, during what part of the day did you do this reflective business when you came to those major decisions you made? Was it during the working hours, or during your walks, or when you got home?
Well, it was during all of them. Always thinking about what was pending, and hoping that the final decision would be correct. I thought about them on the walks, I thought about them in the morning and the afternoon, and then thought about them after I went to bed, and then did a lot of reading to see if I could find out some background of history which would affect what had to be done.
Mr. President, the present occupant of the White House is supposed to be interested before he leaves to sit down and to devise some scheme or outline some plan by which the President of the United States and the top executive officers can have periods of contemplation. What do you think that means?
Well, presidents have always had periods of contemplation when they want to make them. The president doesn't have to see anybody unless he wants to. And if he wants to think about a subject, he has plenty of time to do it. Although he has six jobs, and each one of them is a full-time job, he can, anytime he feels like it, sit down and think through a problem. And it's been done by every president of the United States, I think.
Well, don't presidents have difficulty getting perspective on things and situations and issues because they're so completely shuttered from the outside?
Well, yes, that's true. But then when the president wants to find out what's going on, he can find out. I spent a great deal of time going over all the newspapers, although I didn't believe half what I saw in them. And then I had people who made tours around over the country, who made tours to Europe, and who made special reports to me, and by comparing that with what the propaganda has put out in the papers was, I finally came to a conclusion which I thought was right.
Well, who were these men, some of these men that you sent out to make...
They were individuals which I had confidence in, and I don't want to name them because it caused an embarrassment.
That's all right. They were trusted.
I could trust them. They were honest.
Friends.
And they'd give me a right report.
Now, you had liaison with the Congress. Every president has his men who are assigned to keeping liaison with the Congress. But you, more than anyone, kept direct personal touch with all of your former associates on the Hill, did you not?
Yes, I knew them all. I knew all. When I went to the White House, I knew every member of the Senate. I knew more than half the members of the House. was personally acquainted with the leaders on both sides of the aisle, in both the House and the Senate. And I could talk to them anytime I wanted to, and did. And they, those men, when they know they're not going to be quoted to their disadvantage, will tell you what they think is right. And that's what I went on.
Is it difficult for a former senator to get his former associates to get out of one relationship and treat the president as a president and regard him as a president?
Well, of course it's difficult, but then I never asked him to do that. I always associated with my friends in the Senate and the House, too, on the same basis I did when I was in the Senate. I never had any trouble in that line at all.
Well, Mr. President, since you've left the White House, how have you been kept informed of things now? For example, what do you read? What newspapers do you read?
Well, I read a half a dozen newspapers, just like I always did. Try to get the information. And then I'm in touch with a great many people in the Senate and the House who keep me informed on things, just as they always did. And sometimes I have a chance to talk with the people who receive confidential information, which I never use publicly.
What magazines, for example, do you read? You don't read just a special type of magazines, or you try to get a cross-section?
Well, I read all the current magazines that are published, Harper's Weekly and the
Time and Newsweek.
Time and Newsweek and the
Best News.
The Saturday Review Literature. And they, even after they've become an advertising medium, I read the the Digest. And I'm sorry that they got into the advertising business because they didn't need it. And I'm very much afraid that their attitude and position will be changed by what they get for advertising, which they didn't need at all.
What type of books, Mr. President, do you still continue to favor? Books on history and biography?
History and biography, that's right. I read them all. I got one, a good one, the other day on Alexander Hamilton. And I've just been reading one of the nicest things I've ever seen on the Civil War, the blockade runners. And I try to keep up with all those things, but there's too much of it. I can't keep up with all of it, but I read as much of it as I can.
What about some light reading from time to time?
Well, I sometimes read whodunit. Earl Stanley Gardner always sends me his latest book inscribed to me. He used to send two of them to Charlie Ross, and after Charlie died, he keeps sending me one. And I read for recreation sometimes a lot of whodunits, but after you read about three or four pages, you can always tell what they're going to come out with. That's what Roosevelt used to do. He used to read them and wonder how they were going to come out, and when he'd get over about, I'd say a dozen pages, he could always tell how they're going to come out. He and I used to discuss that.
That's interesting. That was his feeling, too.
That's right. I don't think anybody I've ever come in contact with read more or was more familiar with the history and background of the country than was Franklin Roosevelt.
That's very interesting. He was a good deal interested, especially, too, and I suppose, in naval things, because he fancied himself.
Well, yes, he was a naval officer in the beginning, but he was just as well interested in all the rest of the functions of the government as he was in the naval affairs. And I think the results showed that in his approach to the United Nations and several other things. And when he found out that I was more interested in helping him to win the war than making a headline for myself, I used to get into the back door once or twice a week. Nobody knew that.
Did you ever discuss any particular historians, since you were both interested in history? Did you get to ever take apart the beards for their...
Well, yes. We did discuss them because the beards went haywire, and it was too bad because old man Beard was a great historian. But he got a partial view on the subject, and that didn't work. But we did discuss the various historians of times past, the historians of the war between the states and the historians of the Napoleonic era, and the historians of the previous time when the Islamite approach to the conquest of Europe was going on, with Charles Martel at Tours, when he turned them back, and with the fellow at Belgrade, Hunyadis at Belgrade.